Welcome to the Drop-In CEO podcast. I'm Deb Cobiello, and as the Drop-In CEO, I drop into businesses and assume the CEO role to mitigate crises and help teams get back on track. This podcast is about helping the C-suite leader to navigate challenges with confidence. For today's leader, I'm here to help you get back on track. Tomorrow's leader, let me partner with you to learn the secrets of the C-suite. Wherever you're at in your career, this is the podcast for you. Hello, I am Deb Cobiello, founder of the Drop-In CEO, and I'm so grateful you've dropped in today for another episode of an amazing interview with great people I had the good fortune of having in my network, and today is no exception. If you love this episode, as always, I ask for you to share it generously with your community. When we help others, we leave our legacy, and just know that I am here to help the C-suite leader of today and tomorrow to navigate their challenges with confidence. And today, I have the good fortune of finding this amazing individual, Mike Burness, who has been in senior leadership roles for many years in multinational corporations, PE-held entities, and family-owned companies. His key talent is transforming his functional area into competitive advantage. Oh my, I can't wait to go there. Whether it is in quality, product safety, regulatory affairs, bioterrorism, business continuity, crisis management, you hear me talk about that all the time, directly links the function to the overall company strategy, enabling growth and development of both the business and his teams. And his bio goes on much more, but I will leave him to tell the rest of the story. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hi, Deb. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm honored to spend time with you and the audience. And I hope some things that we talk about and that we share can help them, because it's all about helping other folks navigate new things and challenging things in their careers. A little bit about my backstory, bit of a funny story. I graduated college on a Saturday, and that Monday, my mom said my rent was due at the end of the month. And I kind of was like, okay, I guess I need to go find a job. And I ended up getting a position with Campbell Soup Company. It was the beginning of a career in food and food safety and quality, and that's spanned decades. So it's an interesting kind of, I fell into it because I had to pay some bills. I didn't seek out Campbell's. I didn't seek out to do the quality and the food safety stuff. I just kind of landed in it. I loved it. I met some really, really good people. And Campbell's was just an amazing place to cut your teeth and kind of get embroiled, if you will, in manufacturing and facility management and supply chain and all those areas. So I'm rather lucky there. So I spent a little bit of time in the Camden, New Jersey plant. And then there was an opportunity in their Swanson TV dinner facility in South Carolina. So off I go. This New Jersey boy heading to South Carolina to work in a fully integrated poultry manufacturer, killing chickens and turkeys and cooking and freezing and all kinds of really cool stuff. So regulatory impact from USDA and FDA, obviously. Stayed there for about 3 years. They sold that facility and I went to a private company, a turkey manufacturer in Harrisonburg, Virginia, the home of JMU. Anybody's familiar with the area, just a beautiful area of the country, as a quality manager for a turkey manufacturer. So mainly Thanksgiving Day turkeys for all intents and purposes, a little bit of ground turkey here and there, and some stuff going to KFC, but in general, it was, you know, the holiday, big turkey day stuff. So stayed there for a little while and met my wife who lived in New Jersey. I lived in Virginia. Question was, who moves? A rhetorical question because everybody knows the answer. So I moved back to New Jersey. And the reason was Campbell actually called me back and said, hey, we have an opportunity in our spice facility. Would you like to do that? And I said, I'd love to. I hadn't done spice before. So all those natural flavors on the label was Campbell's own little spice facility in New Jersey. So I went back there, got married, was there about 5 months, actually. And an opportunity came up at Campbell's in corporate in Camden, New Jersey. And that opportunity was certainly one of the best of my life. And the reason it was, I was the global program manager for food safety. So in a nutshell, I had to sign off on every food safety program that Campbell's had around the world. So at the time, Campbell's owned pickles and mushrooms and beef and chicken and frozen and bakery and cakes. And so I learned so much about so much in so little time, working with different cultures, working with different people, different governments, different business approaches. And it was just absolutely a fascinating opportunity. And I was just so lucky to get it. So I spent about 3 years doing that. And then Pepperidge Farm, which was owned by Campbell, had an opportunity in Connecticut. So off we go to Connecticut. And I'm working at Pepperidge. Stayed there, put in allergen management, food safety controls, ISO 9000, those types of things. Ran the regulatory, customer affairs. Then Pepsi came knocking. And off I went to Valhalla, New York, purchased New York to work for Pepsi. And then they purchased Gatorade, Tropicana, and Quaker Oats. And I went to Chicago. So popped out to Chicago, worked for PepsiCo, QTG out in Chicago. And then left there and went to Chiquita, worked at one of their plants in Franklin Lakes. And a lot of people, as soon as you say Chiquita, you know the bananas. But Chiquita also owned a Fresh Express salad company, so bagged salads. So when you talk about the food safety world, that was certainly pretty high risk stuff. So great learning, great opportunity there. And just a side note that's kind of fun. If you look at the Chiquita Brands episode of Undercover Boss on October 31st in 2010, if you look really fast, you'll see me right at the end sitting in the boardroom. So that was kind of a fun thing. So then Chiquita moved their office. My wife and I decided we wanted to move back closer to home, went to Pennsylvania with Godiva, which was owned by a family company. And actually, Campbell's owned it when I originally started with Campbell's back in the day. So I kind of knew the company, knew the folks. I stayed there for about 3 years. And then Alonza Chemicals called me and said, we have an opportunity. We're splitting out one of our businesses to be prepped for sale to private equity. Would you be interested in coming in and setting up the quality and the product safety and the ISO and blah, blah, blah? And I said, I'd love to do that. So so here I am. Kind of a quick nutshell of my path, which was a little bit linear, but many times zigzag.
Oh my goodness. I have so many questions to ask, but you skipped over like a really important point. You said you graduated on a Saturday and then you had to pay rent. And so you wound up at your particular company and didn't plan for that. What was the plan? What were you thinking when you were leaving school? What was going to be your pursuit?
I actually was debating on a couple of things. I was considering getting an advanced degree. And we'll come back to that because I did get one, but not in the technical world. And or I wanted to get into the pharmaceutical sales or sales of some sort. So I wanted to be a salesperson, believe it or not, which as I look back, I never thought I would ever say that. But I had a couple opportunities to do that and they didn't pan out quick enough. And my mom wanted her rent. You just don't mess with my mom. So I thought, you know what? And then I got to Campbell and I started working in the lab and I loved it. The people were fantastic. The company was fantastic. And I said, you know what? Let's give this a little time and see how it shakes out. 2 years later, I was moving and doing different stuff and learning so, so much. Gosh, I'm in a pretty darn good place here. I shouldn't be testing fate and trying to switch up with something that I just loved it. I really did. I still do.
You know, the interesting thing is I listen to you string together all of these opportunities. And I like the thing about, well, where does the wife live? We'll go with her. Happy wife, happy life.
There
I understand that. And we too have had to, my husband and I, move for our different opportunities. Depending on who has an opportunity, we would make those changes and move as long as it served the entire family. What created pull for you? Because so many leaders, technical leaders that come across my doorstep, quality, regulatory, they'll knock on my door. They're trying to get a promotion within a company. They're trying to get a higher level position outside their company. They get through the final interview and they just can't get over the finish line. And I find so many of them are frustrated because they're really, really talented. And in your situation, there just seemed to be pull. I did this. I took the opportunity. I learned a lot. I made an impact. And then I got a call. And then I got a call. What do you think the difference is for those talented people that are trying to push their way into opportunities and maybe your situation where they pulled you for your value?
I think it's a really great question. And I'll give two examples that that came up and kind of the backstory of the example. Firstly, as far as my wife and my family goes, they are the reason I do everything that I do. They are I'm the luckiest man on the planet and I know it. They are the real pull at the end of the day. But I remember being at PepsiCo shortly after 9/11, actually on 9/11, and my boss at the time said, we need somebody to do bioterrorism prevention. And I said, I'll do that. And then I said, although I have no idea what it is. And I think one of the reasons the pull happened is because, and I'll try to say this kind of simply, you often hear, you know, people are afraid of change. And many people are. I have not found too many people that are afraid of progress. And when you ask somebody, put change in the vein of progress, it becomes a whole different animal. So I looked at the opportunity for bioterrorism and said, I have no idea what it even means. No clue. But there's some people out there that are trying to do things they shouldn't be doing. And let's figure out what it looks like. And I dove in feet first. And said, let's make this the best it can be. I learned from the experts, because I certainly wasn't one by any stretch, people in DHS, people in the university academia sector, and said, you know, what can I learn from them? So that's one thing, is don't stay in the bubble. Look outside and say, hey, in food safety, we do risk management. Well, in bioterrorism, there's risk management. In quality systems, we do audits. Well, in finance, there's audits. In EHS, there's audits. In HR, there's audits. So the audit becomes a strategic capability instead of a tactical quality thing. The bioterrorism opportunity became a bigger strategic opportunity to use the skills that I had used in food safety and quality to an area that I had no idea about, which then got into things like learning about background checks and learning about egress and ingress, and custom trade partnership against terrorism, and false walls in trucks, and all kinds of things that kind of opened the door again back to the food safety and the quality side. So it all kind of dovetailed back in. And I think part of it was because I was willing to raise my hand and say, you know what? Yeah, I'll go do something that just needs to be done. I did a little bit of the same thing with sustainability. So I remember working in the Gatorade lines, and the plants would shut down about every 72 hours to clean their lines. So we just asked the question very silly, and I challenge everybody, especially at sea level, challenge the status quo. There is always another way to do something. Always. Sometimes the first way is not always better, but there's always a better way to do it. It just might take some time and some investment to figure it out. Don't ever give up on that idea. So we asked the question, well, why are the lines going down every 72 hours? And you can guess the answer. Well, it's been that way for 35 years because there was an issue back, Lord knows when, back in the day. And there was a heat-resistant mold issue and blah, blah, blah. So we actually took the science and said, all right, well, when can we shut these lines down? When do we need to shut them down? When does the data tell us that? And the data told us it was about once a week. So we doubled the production output from shutting those lines down simply by asking a very silly question. So in the quality and the food safety world, the regulatory world, there's a lot of rules. And a lot of them are binary in many cases. But challenge that. Challenge whether or not it's truly binary, or is there another way to get to the same place? And that will eventually, I think, evolve itself into economics. So I mentioned early in my career, well, even before I had a career, before my rent was due with mom, I said, well, I'll maybe get an advanced degree. I ended up going back and getting an MBA because as I started getting into recalls and crisis management, the questions of, well, okay, we had a recall and now we need to spend money to fix something. And when you go to the executive team and you say, I need money so we have less recalls, it's a lot harder than going and saying, I need $4 million. We need $4 million so we don't have a $34 million issue. So we started figuring out what the economic impact of a lot of that quality and food safety stuff was, which led to the MBA. So I was sitting around one day and I said, if I can't go into this executive team or the board meeting or whatever and talk about business terms, I am not going to be able to get a seat at the table. And the way I need to figure that out is to understand the business side better. And I went back and got an MBA. So coming back and putting value on food safety or quality or regulatory or sustainability or crisis management or a lot of those things was so much fun. And it answered questions that were perennial in the quality space. Funny, good example is customer complaints. So customer complaints are often tracked in the quality world, and they can be complaints to a consumer, for a customer, per million, whatever metric you use. And the question is, well, what's a good complaint number? And ask people. And people will say, well, I'm not sure. Well, I mean, you can argue the Six Sigma, say 3.4 is good, or 5 is good, or 5 is best in class, and 1 is less than 1 is best in show, parts per million. But you start putting dollars on it, and it changes everything. So at Pepsi, we were able to put dollar numbers on customer complaints. So when we went out to the bottlers, who at that time were their own franchise owners, Pepsi didn't own the bottlers, and they would ask us, well, why do we have to do this stuff in the 90 days of summer, let's say, which is Memorial Day, Labor Day, the hot selling season? You can start talking about, well, for each complaint you get, it costs you this much money. So now you can estimate the complaints based on historical data and say, here's what happens to your business in these 3 months if you don't do X, Y, or Z. And they're business people. They get it. So as soon as you say, you know, your revenue is going to go down, your velocity is going to shrink, whatever, bing, you have somebody that's willing to listen to you instead of, well, it's motherhood and apple pie and it's a nice thing to do.
So amazing. And I appreciate your insights. First of all, I'll do it because what you were able to articulate so well is that you had certain skills that people valued and you can transfer them to other things. I remember myself working for a client. I too was moving them from ISO 22000 to FSSC 22000. We went on that journey together and then the customer had a new requirement. I need a suite of EH&S documentation. And I said, I've never done that before. And he says, don't worry, we'll learn together. Because I'd already helped them to put their entire food safety system together from a documentation perspective. Trust yourself, you can be resourceful, learn from others, and you can do it. But I had the capability to do it. I just had to figure out the technical side of it. So kudos to you for having that can-do attitude.
I think the other part is looking at it strategically. To your point on EHS, or if you pick ISO 14 or ISO 26 or any of them, pretty much document control is sitting in every one of them. So when you do document control for FSSC and then somebody says, well, what do we do for NHS? It's the same strategic approach. They're just different documents. So tactically, there's some work to do, but strategically, kind of the same approach.
I wanted to take a moment to remind you that a recent study showed nearly 60% of leaders feel depleted at the end of the day. And this feeling is a key indicator of burnout and makes it difficult to lead and inspire others. If you've ever experienced that restless exhaustion, you know why CEOs are amongst the most likely candidates for experiencing job frustration. I wrote The CEO's Compass, your guide to get back on track, to confront those feelings and create a plan that is sustainable for you and your organization. I created a 7-point assessment that will help you figure out your problems in days, not months. And it includes so many resources, worksheets, videos, and much, much more. If this is you, please head over to my website, dropinceo.com, and click on my products, the CEO's Compass, and order yours on Amazon or other outlets. And now, back to the conversation. So you have so many unique thoughts. And one of the reasons why I wanted to bring you onto the show again, I really, really respect quality food safety professionals being extremely smart and trying to mitigate risk throughout the organization. But you also really, really have some unique thoughts. I love your brand because you put out such a strong, positive message for the area of quality and food safety. It's not technical drudgery, but almost an exciting place to be able to make a difference. And you have some very unique thoughts about AI, AI strategy, and potentially the benefits of how we can leverage this in the area of quality and food safety. And I've never heard this before, so I'd love to hear your perspective on this.
I think there's a lot of opportunities, and obviously I'll use the term new, but in technology terms, not so much, but it's a new area, but I think the applications are limitless. So a couple silly examples, but real ones. So I remember vividly going around in the GMP world and looking at insect traps in manufacturing plants and counting the number of flies and the number of moths or the number of whatever. What I always had a challenge seeing is somebody figuring out, okay, when are there more flies coming in and less gnats and more of this and less of that? And what do we do when that happens? Same thing with rodents. So in the summer, you have more rodent activity. Where's it coming in? What do we see? Somebody would go around and say, all right, I found a rodent in this little station and I found one over here. What happens if a rodent goes in that station, it triggers a note, the flag goes up, it sends an email or a notification, a warning to a map and says, I have a rodent that just walked in here. You don't have to go around and check the traps. The trap checks itself. Then you start using the big data approach of, all right, well, what's coming in and where's it coming in? Whether it's rodents, bugs, flies, loads coming in the back door, how many trailers weren't sealed, how many seal numbers didn't work, and start trending that data to predict when you're going to need to do something before you need to do it. And think about the world of food safety, and let's talk produce for a minute. So you're out in the field, and you know people say, I want healthy greens, spinach, lettuce. It is grown outside in the elements. So by default, it is a pretty high risk, can be a high risk product. Birds fly by, reptiles, deer, whatever. So what happens if you start looking at what kind of intrusions in the field you have from animals? So deer came in over here, a coyote came in over there, a pig came in over here. Now you know that there's a higher risk of potential contamination in this area of the block or, you know, the harvest area, and you focus resources on it. Instead of blindly walking every field and trying to find out where they came in, you can put monitors up, whether they be game cams, whatever, and say, hey, I saw something go through here. What is that something? And then you can start figuring out if it's, you know, if it's a cow, you've got a potentially, or a deer, you got a potentially E. coli risk. If it's bird strafings, you got some salmonella potential. So you can kind of start figuring out, do I have a higher risk of food safety in this block because of the activity around it? You know, did it rain? Did it not? So I think there's a lot of applications, and they're somewhat endless when you get to some of the preventative and predictive, because being predictive is where you win. Being preventative typically happens after something goes wrong, which is too late. So preventative action is typically a result of corrective action. Corrective action is a result of something not working. So preventative action is kind of where you get ahead of the game. So I translate that then into people and people capability. And I tend to differentiate training and education. And training is knowing what to do, but education is knowing why you're doing it. And you can train people in an SOP, and as long as everything works the way the SOP says, everything's fine. Until Wednesday night at midnight or 3 a.m., because it's always third shift, when it doesn't quite work that way, and then they don't know what to do. So think of AI and even augmented reality, so AR, VR, and having somebody learning how to manage a food safety issue in a manufacturing plant. Pick something like a metal detector knockoff or a failure of a screen. And somebody walks through that training with an if-then scenario. So that person's a line inspector, a production manager, and the screen breaks. What do you do? Okay, I do this. Okay, then if they do that, then the program goes this way. If they do this, then the program goes that way. And you could even have it to be a little bit of fun and say, if they end up making a lot of wrong decisions, they end up in court defending the company against a lawsuit. which could very well and has happened. So I think there's a huge application of this in the business world, finance for auditors, you know, looking at books, looking at audit trails, doing that in AR, VR, or AI space, using the plethora of information that's out there to create scenarios to help people learn how to do critical thinking and not be a robot engineer ticking off an audit box.
This so resonates with me because I too, having been the head of quality and food safety, you think you're doing everything right because the ISO or the FSSC or BSI, all the standards prescriptively say, here is how you do your HACCP plan from A to B to C, putting your critical control points, et cetera. And it looks good on paper, especially if you audit it from A to B to Z. And where we got bit was not considering the interactions of unexplained circumstances or activity with that process. And exactly that. The third shift person who can't find their cleaning tool will cross boundaries into another area to get their cleaning tool, trying to do their job the right way, but potentially introducing a pathogen in a new environment that never ever came up in a HACCP plan. We are blindsided sometimes by just relying on these food safety standards to try to identify and mitigate risk. But we have to go in with our eyes open at a broader set of data that helps us to make sure, are we sure? And can we sleep at night? And so I just love what you brought forward.
Well, I think the other comment, you know, you mentioned audits, and a lot of audits are done for compliance. And while that is absolutely critical, I also believe that they also should be done for effectiveness. So yes, you can comply with something and be completely ineffective. You can also not comply with something and be very effective. But you have to balance those things, because if you're complying with something and being ineffective, then there's an opportunity to improve that process. And if somebody's not compliant, and I spent half my career in manufacturing plants, and it was an absolute blessing, because you would sometimes get a document from corporate and it would be 9 pages long. And the plant looks at it and goes, I can't do anything with this. You know, I need a postcard this big that I can stick on the line so people can do stuff. That translates itself into you can be compliant and completely ineffective. But a plant will oftentimes, you'll find that they may not be compliant, but they may be more effective. And if they're more effective, then you have to ask yourself, what are they doing that makes sense that our other facilities can do? Because they may not be compliant with your corporate rule. They're going to be compliant with the law. That's a no-brainer. That has to happen. But you have a rule for whatever reason. You know, you have to check something every 2 hours. And you start looking at the, you know, the SPC data or the Six Sigma data, and it turns out they've never had an out of spec in the history of mankind. Okay, why am I doing that every 2 hours? It's not logical for me to do that. So if that costs a person, let's say an hour, and product's held for an hour, the carrying cost of that product, that person's time, the testing cost, all for what? And if you're making a lot of that over the course of a year, it runs into some big numbers. I remember being in a plant and they had 650 bait stations around the outside of the facility. And the corporate rule was they had to check them once a week. And the guy that did it looked at me and said, you check them once a week. Because there's no way he could do it. He couldn't physically get it done. Yet, they had the best rodent and pest control program in the entire company. So he had other ways of doing what he needed to do. And he found a better way to do it. So he was not compliant, but much more effective. And I think a good auditor will ask those questions. Are you compliant and are you effective? And if you are effective and not compliant, maybe that corporate standard needs to get looked at.
Yeah, when I think about, you bring up another great thought. I love this conversation, is the purpose of an auditor. An auditor can help you sleep at night to, if you just want to check the box and say we're compliant and stay out of jail. But a really good auditor will, to your point, evaluate the effectiveness, because they're really there to provide an outside perspective to create value based on what they see. So it gets professionals, quality professionals' orders, to think versus just do. And to your point earlier on, ask the question, challenge the status quo, seek to understand. There may be a good reason for a standard, or maybe an opportunity to say it might be beneficial to evolve it.
Right.
Love that. Love that. I got to go here. This is going to go just a little bit longer because I remember during our discovery call, you started bringing up something around a competency model for quality. Again, quality is near and dear to my heart. Again, engineering background, quality and operational excellence, very talented people that I have great respect for. And I want them to be able to excel, be their best, and provide the most value. But you had some very unique thoughts about this that I'd love for you to bring forward.
The most rewarding part of my career has been developing teams and people, hands down. It is absolute heaven for me to see somebody grow and end up doing what they want to do and get to better places. So back a while ago, we looked at where the team was, and this was back in the PepsiCo days. We said, well, where are the team members? And you know, you get the HR developmental plan and the career pathing and backfills and that stuff that you do every year, which is good stuff. How do you start connecting those to a person's personal development? And what we thought was, well, okay, the leadership model is often in the HR world and kind of the corporate-wide one, but the functional one, what does somebody need to know and be able to demonstrate to be successful in food safety or quality or regulatory or supply chain or whatever? So we went and we created a competency model made up of, think of it like a pizza, and each of the slices was a different area. So quality engineering, auditing, quality systems, value chain, laboratory, regulatory. So there were a lot of categories or pizza slices. Then we went and said, okay, there's three areas that we'll break these down into. So if you're early in your career or junior, if you will, more junior, then here's what we expect you to know in each of these eight pizza slices. And then if you're in the middle of your career, here's what we expect you to know. And then if you're later in your career, here's what we expect you to know. And to be simplistic, it kind of flowed in the more junior area. You were working on something in a facility, in a specific product or a specific line. In the middle of career, you were doing it multi-facility, multi-country, multi-line. And then later, you were influencing externally. So you were doing things like ISO standard development with the ISO group or tag stuff. And that evolved for each of those categories. Then we went and said, okay, so let's take every job in the organization and map it against what the expectations are for all these eight pieces of pizza. And we did that. So if somebody was a supply-based auditor, so they were going out and looking at suppliers, and they said, I want to be a quality systems auditor, they would then go to the map and say, all right, I need to understand quality systems better, to the middle part, and I need to understand regulatory a little bit better, but I don't necessarily have to know all about the suppliers. So they would then create their own career map to say, here's where I am, here's where I want to go, and here are the functional competencies I need to be able to demonstrate to be ready for that position when it opens. Now, a couple caveats. It is not a check the box exercise. So somebody goes, oh, look, I did all these things, now promote me to senior grand poobah of all things in the galactic enterprise. Doesn't work like that. What it does is it helps somebody fill the functional competencies that they will need to be successful, coupled with the leadership model, that is the soft skills. So teamwork, collaboration, empathy, EQ, IQ, all that other stuff. So they go hand in hand. It wasn't a one-off. And the other part of that became a critical experience model. So you, of all people, will appreciate this. And that critical experience model was things that you have to live to be able to understand. You don't live it, you don't get it. Example, you go through a class on how to do crisis management. And it's do this and do that and do that. When the FDA walks in your office on Friday at 3 o'clock, flips their bag on the front desk, that's when you get it. That's a critical experience. You have to live through a recall. Instead of just understanding it, you got to live through it to be able to fully comprehend what it is. Same like M&A. You can talk about, well, now we're going to go do M&A. Okay, that's easy to talk about. Yeah, we have to bring finance together. We have to bring the cultures together. How you do that is different almost every time. There's a playbook, but until you're on the field snapping the ball, you kind of don't understand the play. So it was a critical experience model complemented by the company leadership model. So it was both sides of that coin, functional and leadership, and critical experiences. And then people would go every year and put their career map together, their developmental plan, and they start throwing in what they needed to do to get where they wanted to be. And the whole objective was, look, we want this team to have a career with this company, not just a job. People can get jobs lots of places, but having a career is all different.
Mike, I just want to say, first of all, thank you. I've never heard about that particular competency model. I mean, you see them through the HR space, but breaking it down by some of these technical areas combined with leadership essentials, I've never heard it before. So I so appreciate your unique thoughts. You know, I have a lot of respect for senior leaders in this space, such as yourself, but I've never had the experience where you so articulately explained. Just, it's a cool place to be. There is a lot of value that we can provide, not just can I sleep at night because I can comply and stay out of jail. There are so many things that we can provide value that the quality and the regulatory space should always have a seat at the table versus being seen maybe as that person that says no or holds you back or slows things down. We can be a valuable partner to mitigate risk in the organization and protect brand trust. So I know there are so many questions I didn't ask you, but we want to bring this to a close because I think people have really, really gotten a true understanding of who you are as a leader, as a person, as respected quality regulatory and ABC professional. Any last thoughts before we bring this to a close? And I do want people to reach out to you, get to know you, and you should be on other podcasts. So any other last thoughts, Mike?
Yeah, there are a couple. I think as businesses grow and flourish, don't ever lose sight of the people that make it all happen. It's very easy to do that. We transitioned into private equity with Lonza and now Arxada. It was the first time I had been owned by in a company that's owned by private equity. It's actually owned by two private equity companies. And they're both fantastic. And you know, one of the differences between that and a company owned is the private equity team has a whole portfolio of companies. So you're a company in a portfolio of however many, and they're all different in many cases. They're not all chemical manufacturers or healthcare. They're all over the board. So the great news is you have a lot of professionals that do the same thing you do in a different space. So it's a great place to learn from. One of the challenges can be that not every company is the same size, the same industry. So the market turns down and impacts a couple of the companies, but not some of the others. So when the private equity company says, we'd like you all to meet this one standard, there's a practicality issue that can come in with, is your company in a position to do that right now? And the answer could be yes, and it could be no. But overall, the private equity experience has been fantastic. And the two companies that owned Arxada are nothing short of fabulous. But in closing, the reason I bring that up, it's about value creation, and every function in the organization needs to create value and should be able to demonstrate that value. On the quality, sustainability, food safety, crisis management, that's where I cut my teeth. I've spent a lot of time with sales and marketing and creating marketing platforms for food safety, creating velocity differences at customer level for quality attributes. So that's what I like to do. And that's what kind of gets me going along with the people thing. So certainly I love helping folks. I probably should have been a teacher in my other life. So please reach out. Any questions, anything I can help you with, be happy to do that. And Deb, you've been absolutely fantastic. It's an honor to know you. And it's been an absolute pleasure to be on your podcast.
And I'll send you my invoice when we're done. But thank you so much for those accolades. And Mike, again, the pleasure has been all mine. I want to wish you well and much success. And thank you for being a great guest.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Drop-In CEO podcast. I hope you are inspired by our conversation and can apply what you heard to your business or career goals. If you found this valuable, please share this show with at least one friend who will find it useful and inspiring. When you share this podcast, it allows me to continue to help C-suite leaders of today and tomorrow to navigate their challenges with confidence. To connect with me or learn more about the Drop-In CEO services, go to my website at dropinceo.com. And until we meet, I wish you well and much success.